Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Thank you for listening, everyone. As always, thank you. We are incredibly grateful and just delighted that so many people listen. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's jolly nice, isn't it?
Yes, more and more people seem to be catching up with us, which is very, very encouraging.
And yeah, that's very good news.
It is, and I think it's been good that we've gone weekly. I think it's, you know, kind of easier for people to get in touch with us.
Get into it
more, and it's, you know, quicker turnaround. So if we do a two-parter, for example, as we did with Ed Kemper, people can get the second part more quickly rather than having to wait, you know,
that's a long time. Very true.
And if you don't know the story, you know, it's you're not surprising. You quite want to find out what happened next. So how's your week been?
Good, yeah. I went to Edinburgh.
Wonderful.
It was very fun, as usual.
It's a great place.
The Fringe is so fun. I would highly recommend anybody who hasn't been to the Fringe to go. It's like really great fun, but it's also like being in a vortex and you just are out and eating and drinking and seeing shows and going from place to place, and you basically can manage about 2 or 3 days before you kind of implode.
Yes,
and have to lie down.
Yeah, and I first went to the Fringe in 1960. I was 15. It was an entirely different thing. It was really, the festival itself was the big deal, you know, the big shows or the big concerts, and you know, and the Fringe was literally tiny. But if you go to it now, it's all-encompassing, relentless, dramatic.
There's stuff on all day from 10 a.m. Yep. to 3 a.m.
Yes, and stuff. If you don't want to sleep, you don't have to.
And there are food stalls and places to drink, and there are people busking and doing acrobatics, and it's really, really fun. The whole city is taken up with it.
Yeah, I do. I like Edinburgh anyway, having lived there a little bit as a teenager. It's a great city. I'm more sentimental about Glasgow because I was born near Glasgow. But there's something about Edinburgh which is unmistakable, whether it's the flinty nature of the sky. It's just extraordinarily clear when you want to clear that.
It's such a beautiful city as well, but so interesting.
Mm.
Also the backdrop for some not true crime. Who writes that? Ian Rankin.
Ian Rankin's Rebus, all set in Edinburgh. There are quite a lot of what's now known as tartan noir. In fact, one of the very best of them is a book called Time for the Dead by Lynn Anderson. She's a forensic psychologist. The lead character, Rona McLeod, is a forensic examiner. And this is the 15th novel. They are very, very good indeed. And indeed, the Daily Record calls it the best Scottish crime series since Rebus.
I like Rebus.
This one is set in Skye, but mostly she works in Glasgow.
Okay, cool.
I like Rebus too, very much. I think, to be fair to Ian, he's kind of run his course now.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely.
You know, it feels tired now, but they're wonderful novels. I've got all of them.
Yeah.
One or two signed, I'm delighted to say.
Oh, definitely. All right, shall we get going?
Yep.
So this week we are doing The Beast of Manchester.
That's right, also known by his proper name as Trevor Joseph Hardy. Hardy would probably be a household name, for he was a truly ruthless serial killer. But because his investigation overlapped with the case of the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, Hardy was somehow became overlooked. In fact, he was, if not as prolific, every bit as fierce and ferocious. In fact, in many ways, worse than Sutcliffe, if even possible to consider. Hardy was born just month before I was, in June 1945, in Moston, in Manchester. Very straight-laced father. Mum was a cleaner. He was the youngest child until his brother Colin turned up, which apparently, according to his brother Colin, who I have to say will appear, didn't much care for Trevor, drove him mad with jealousy. His mother admitted later to being frightened of him, even as a boy. He had, yet again, one of those extraordinary coincidences, or is it? He had an accident and a sliver of bone in his skull. Yet again, a head injury.
He dropped on his head.
Well, I don't think he was dropped, but a sliver of bone was dislodged in his head and pressed on part of his brain. His family said that when it did so, it would cause his aggression. Well, whatever caused it, he got himself a very bad name from the age of eight. He got his first housebreaking conviction at the age of eight in 1953.
Wow.
And by the age, he went through a succession of approved schools as they then were, remand homes, and later when you got older, Borstal. At 15, he got his first criminal conviction and was put in jail for a series of 20-odd burglaries. The judge said, and he was absolutely right, the public needed to be protected from him. Over the period of time, over the next few years, he got over 140 convictions. He drank heavily. He got into fights. He was only a small man. He grew up to about 5'7". But he was banned from a lot of pubs because he was always picking a fight. He was a very, very belligerent man. And he then started on more burglary and then boasting about it. But he never took things. He would only take cash because it was easier to get rid of. He didn't want to, you know, want to fence anything.
Fair enough.
Okay. Nevertheless, this belligerent, boastful, vicious man got into a fight in 1972 with a friend of his about who should pay for the next round of drinks. Typically, Hardy attacked him. There was a fight and he hit him with a pickaxe handle.
Which he just happened to have
about his person, yes. He was given 5 years for wounding with intent. And the judge, in this case, told him he was a menace to society. Right again. He certainly was. Nevertheless, he goes to jail. He spends his time in Albany Jail in the Isle of Wight. And he becomes obsessed with A, the chap he had the fight with, and B, he'd got a much younger girlfriend. And when I say much younger, I do mean much. She was 14 and she was called Beverly Driver.
That's illegal.
No, it wasn't. It was extremely illegal. But nevertheless, this didn't affect Hardy in the slightest. So when he finally gets out of jail, he's given time off for, quotes, good behaviour, and gets out of jail on the 18th of November, 1974. Now, the rage that he has been feeling while he's been in jail, festering, if you like, about the chap he hit with the pickaxe handle, mm-hmm, and Beverly, who, incidentally, while he's in jail, writes one of those Dear John letters. I found some of my own age.
Right.
So he gets out of jail and he travels back to Manchester. And he said himself later, he told the police later, I sat on the train saying O'Brien and Beverly again and again and again. When he gets to his parents' house in Moston in Manchester, they tell him that O'Brien has died.
Has he died?
He had, yes.
Oh. Not from the pickaxe.
Well, as a result of the injuries of the jail. In fact, O'Brien never worked again and died as a result of the injuries, but he wasn't tried for murder. Hardy is still obsessed with Beverly. He's a bit disappointed about O'Brien because he was clearly intent on killing him. Mm-hmm. Goes round to Beverly's house and throws an axe through the window.
Where does he get all his weapons from?
Well, it's a speculation. However, he didn't actually spot her. Now, what exactly happened and what precisely was the motivation, no one will ever know. But what is abundantly clear is that in the months of November and December 1974, Hardy had become explosive. On New Year's Eve 1975, he spots a girl called Janet Leslie Stewart, 15, who he thinks looks like Beverly Driver. She's quite a tall, good-looking girl, older than looks older than she really was. And she was going off to meet her boyfriend to a New Year's Eve party. But she never arrived at the party. A search was launched and posters were put up across the city, but she was never found. In fact, she'd fallen into the clutches of the furious, belligerent, vicious Trevor Joseph Hardy. At one point, he said later, "Oh, I mistook her for Beverly." I'm sure that was absolutely untrue. I think he was just furious at 15-year-olds. And he stabbed her in the neck, dragged her to a secluded spot and buried her in a shallow grave in a clay pit.
That's it. He didn't assault her or anything.
Ah, that's all in good time. Over the following weeks, he returned to the body. Not something we're unfamiliar with.
A la Ted Bundy.
A la Ted Bundy, a la Ed Kemper.
Mm-hmm.
A la a number.
Mm-hmm.
And he effectively dismembered the corpse. He threw the head into a lake, cut off her feet and hands. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the man in the canal?
Mm-hmm.
He even took her wristwatch and ring and gave them to his girlfriend, a woman called Sheila Farrow, for her birthday.
Ugh, horrible.
Farrow was quite a good bit older than Hardy, incidentally, and they lived together in a flat in Newton Heath, not far from where he buried the body. But let's put it this way. He mutilated this innocent 15-year-old and clearly took a great deal of pleasure in it. 6 months pass and he kills for the second time. This time it's a 17-year-old called Wanda Scala. She's works in a local pub in Moston. You know, all the killings are within a... Not like
geographical range.
Not like Robert Black, who was all over the country. They're all close nigh. She's been playing pool at the, you know, where she works, and she sets off home around midnight. She was killed just a few hundred yards from her front door. Hardy battered her over the head with a paving stone and strangled her with her own socks before tearing off her clothes. And before he buried her on a nearby building site, they were actually constructing a petrol station, he bit off one of her nipples. He kept her clothes and her handbag as a trophy. She was found 2 days later next day, a passerby saw two legs projecting from under a pile of bricks. And originally, the police thought it might have been the body of Leslie, the first girl who disappeared on New Year's Eve. But no, it wasn't. She was semi-naked. Her face had been mutilated by a large stone found nearby so that her features couldn't be distinguished. She'd been bitten on the abdomen. Part of it I can't go on about, but he had absolutely... mutilated the poor girl. And yet again, he returns to the site. Though this time she's been found, he returns to the site and leaves one of her platform shoes.
What, so they find her?
Without the shoes.
Without, and then he comes back and puts the shoes there.
Yes. This is taunting. He's saying, "What a clever boy I am. You know, look at me." It was extraordinary. But yet again, It was random. It wasn't Wanda's boyfriend. You know, the classic police inquiry will involve, you know, whoever the boyfriend was, father, nearby, all of the classic formulations, if you like. And Hardy, for all intents and purposes, has got away with it again. But his vanity and that boastful quality, in the end, overcomes him. His younger brother, Colin, whom he doesn't like, goes back to Manchester, and he and Hardy go out for a drink together. Hardy starts boasting about the Scala murder. And indeed says, why are you so interested? And Hardy apparently says, according to his brother, oh, well, I did it, in a rather matter-of-fact tone. There is a fight. But this time, his brother decides he's going to go to the police. So he goes to the police, and Hardy is arrested on suspicion. One clue was the bite mark on Wanda's breast. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, clearly, any good forensic odontologist would be able to match Hardy's teeth marks to the bite mark.
Yeah.
Now, Hardy is aware of that. And so he persuades his girlfriend, Sheila, to bring a file. It's like an old-fashioned prison story, isn't it? Bring a file in her bag so that he can file his teeth. So the teeth marks on Wanda will not match his teeth.
The thought of filing your own teeth makes you feel really queasy.
Well, I suppose if you're trying to escape a murder charge. But he has a greater hold over Sheila. She gives him an alibi for Wanda's murder. So now all the police have is the brother's statement. It's he said, she said.
He said, he said.
Yeah. Hardy is released. No trial takes place. He got a suspended sentence for assaulting his brother in the wake of the argument in the pub.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately for his brother, things went very badly wrong in the wake of that argument. And he, in turn, found himself behind bars for a time. So here we have Hardy's got away with, apparently, two murders. And December 1975, is it not absolutely typical? We can produce further examples. Hardy sets a fire in a local council house and saves his neighbours. And it's absolutely classic narcissist behaviour. He wants to be a hero, so he sets the fire and then saves the neighbours. Again, if you're looking...
notoriety in some way all the time.
It's absolutely that. And think of how many times we've talked about that sort of behaviour, not just English, but around the world.
Yeah.
Look at me. He actually became a, quotes, hero in local press for saving his neighbours. It wasn't until much later it was discovered that he'd set the fire himself. Things progressed for a further 3 months. We're now in March 1976. He attacks a 21-year-old girl called Christina Campbell in a pub toilet. Bear in mind, he spends a great deal of his time in pubs. He squeezed her throat so hard that she bit a part of her tongue off.
Oh, my God.
But he was disturbed and she got away and gave the police a description of Hardy. Really a rather good description of Hardy. So now Hardy knows that the police are searching for him and actively. And on the 9th of March, just a few days later, he finds another victim. This is a 17-year-old girl called Sharon Mossoff. Sharon was at a party. She was going to get an overnight bus, an all-night bus home in Manchester. she'd called her mother and said, "What number do I need to get?" Unfortunately, she worked at a place called Marlborough Mill, and Hardy, drunk as ever, was trying to burglarise the shop, and mill shop. And Sharon passed, and I'm afraid he fell into her clutches.
She fell into his clutches.
Mm-hmm. She was stabbed with a screwdriver, strangled with her tights, beaten around the head, stripped of her clothes. Once again, he bit off a nipple. But this time, he threw her into the Rochdale Canal, at Failsworth and Oldham, because he feared, well, he was anxious about the possibility of what we now call DNA.
Well, I mean, don't kill your victim in exactly the same way.
No, quite. I agree with that. But once again, he returned to the body and used a metal rivet to scratch the breast that he'd mutilated so that his teeth marks wouldn't show. The man who went to some lengths. When she was finally found, it was a cold night. The water in the canal had frozen round her. It wasn't until the 23rd of April, 6 weeks later, that the police finally tracked down Hardy. And in another classic, he's living with Sheila Farrow, his girlfriend, again. And he's hiding in the attic. Levi Belfield hid in the attic when they finally arrested him. But this time, Sheila decides to come clean. She tells the police she wasn't with Hardy when Wanda was killed, nor could she give him an alibi for the night that Sharon was killed. Both girls, of course, had the bite marks. Hardy, this time, was charged with two murders and held. 5 months later, in August 1976, while he was in custody, Hardy specifically asked for a meeting with the police. He wrote a 40-page confession admitting to both murders as well as the first mm-hmm. of Janet Leslie Stewart. He said how anguished he'd become, how he'd been treated by his former friend who he'd hit with a pickaxe, and that he was bitter about being dumped by Beverly Driver while he was in prison. She'd written to him, "I don't want to waste my life on someone like you." This, according to his written confession, meant that he approached, 6 weeks later, 17-year-old Leslie Stewart, mistaking her quotes for Driver. He admitted that he'd cut her throat with a knife and partially buried her. He said Wanda was different. She disturbed him in the process of a robbery. Oh, it's complete nonsense. He no sexual motive to Wanda's attack, but he'd read a book. Oh, he'd read. I'd be astounded if he actually ever read a book about serial sadist Neville Heath, and thought he should make the murder look sexual to hide the fact that it was a failed robbery. Oh, please. Finally, on the 2nd of September 1976, Hardy took the Greater Manchester Police to where he'd buried Janet Leslie Stewart, where, of course, her headless, dismembered corpse was discovered. Had it not been for the fact that Peter Sutcliffe was terrorising prostitutes and young women across Leeds and Bradford almost exactly the same time, Trevor Hardy would be notorious. Mm. But as it was, the enormous police hunt, the fantastic publicity associated with the Yorkshire Ripper, pushed Hardy to the back of the queue. In fact, he was to go on trial in April 1977. Both his brother and Sheila Farrow provided testimony, and there was some forensic evidence linking him to Scala and Mossop. But most important of all, perhaps, is that The psychiatrist at the trial said that he was a pathological sexual deviant who illustrated remorseless brutality in action. Hardy, not surprisingly, said he wasn't guilty, but he admitted to unlawfully killing the girls. And he also admitted to strangling the girl in the pub toilet.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, he trots out how upset he was by Beverly and hitting the man with the pickaxe.
Well, that's no excuse, though.
Absolutely. But I think the final nail in his proverbial coffin was that one of the psychiatrists said there was no doubt he derived aggressive sexual satisfaction from mutilating the bodies of his victims, and he was a woman hater who could kill again. Hopelessly evil and dangerous. It took the jury of 6 men and 6 women 70 minutes to convict him at Manchester Crown Court in May 1977. Mr. Justice Caulfield, the judge, said, "This area is a happy place, but it will be a happier place without you." Hardy was sent to jail, originally with a minimum term, but later, in 2008, was given a whole life tariff at the Royal Court by Mr. Justice Teare, who described him as an utterly wicked sex killer who must now serve his whole rest of his life. Hardy appealed persistently, but finally, on the 25th of September 2012, Hardy died of a heart attack in Wakefield. In the last 15 years he was in prison, he hasn't been visited by a soul.
Oh my God, really?
No. He was, quite rightly, abandoned. There was a suspicion that he might have been guilty of at least one further crime, a girl called Dorothy Layden in 1971, but there were various other violent attacks on women in Manchester at the time. But there was never any firm evidence that that was Hardy. It could have been, but we can't be absolutely sure of it. It's before he goes to jail for the pickaxe attack. But what I would say about Hardy, and what I think is very interesting about him, is that he shows many of the classic symptoms: troubled childhood, violent aggression.
He wasn't abused or anything as a child.
No question of abuse.
Just that he was aggressive and
violent
as a child.
Yes, very aggressive as a child. So much so that his mother said she was terrified of him, even as a child. It's the question that we're always asked, isn't it? Is it nurture or nature?
Born evil.
Is this an evil gene? Or was it something?
I mean, sounds like it. Sounds more like a kind of Beverly Allitt, like.
Yes.
Attention seeking.
Yeah.
Or just the very aggressive for somebody.
Yeah.
Upsetting him while him being dumped and being put in prison.
But I'm not saying any serial killer should be glamorized. But there is something about Hardy which is, in a way, particularly chilling, because he jolly nearly got away with it.
Mm.
Had he not let the girl go, you know, when she bit her tongue in the pub toilet, there wouldn't have been a proper description. And had he not gone on to kill Sharon Mossoff, the 17-year-old at the end, on the 9th of March 1976...
then he wouldn't be a serial killer.
But perhaps that's by that stage what he wanted.
Yeah, I think at that stage, if got gratification from killing, you're going to kill again.
Yeah. I think it's entirely fair for the judge to say he was likely to kill again. Mm. And society was saved from that. And he died...
alone and unloved.
Alone and perhaps rightfully unloved. Unlike some of the long-term prisoners, he didn't demonstrate,
remorse. Or do restorative work.
No. Books for the blind or Braille or whatever, others may have done. I think it would be entirely appropriate to call him an evil man, a vicious evil man.
Well, thank you. very much, the Beast of Manchester.
Yes. One thing is interesting, Molly, is that this week, British television, ITV, start a drama about a case we've done called Christopher, a man called Christopher Halliwell, the Swindon minicab driver who dumped a body in Savernake Forest.
Oh, yes. I'm getting him confused with Christopher Jenkins.
Christopher Halliwell, who in the end took Detective Superintendent Steve Fulcher to the location of the body.
Oh, yes, and then got him to say the wrong, he didn't read him his rights.
No. And it's a very, very good story.
Fulcher messed up the case.
Fulcher messed up the case, and it cost him his job in the end. But it's a very, very good...
Who's in it?
Martin Freeman's playing Fulcher.
Oh, hold on, isn't Imelda Staunton in it?
I think so.
That's cool. I'm just going to find which podcast it was that we did him on, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
What's his name?
Christopher Halliwell.
Not the smirking minicab killer.
Yep.
Oops, I'm going to start playing. I don't want to do that. Plus, no, details. Yeah, so it's season 3, episode 3.
Yep.
The smirking minicab killer.
Yep.
If you want to have a look at that.
Yeah,
listen.
Sorry. Listen to it.
A listen rather than a look. And then a look at the TV show.
Yes. I suspect Freeman will be very good. And it is a very interesting case because you may recall part of the drama was, as you quite rightly said a moment ago, that Fulcher didn't read Halliwell his rights because he was convinced that he might be able to find the particular victim alive. And there were a whole series of... Fulcher was well-intentioned but mistaken.
Yeah.
A great moral dilemma. As you know better than I, moral dilemmas always make for great drama.
True, very true. I think you know that better than me. You probably watch more drama in your life than I have.
Well,
just because I work in the entertainment industry doesn't mean I necessarily know all there is to know about.
Anyway, Mo, that's that. What you got coming up?
Nothing. Next week is quiet.
Oh well, that's always a good sign,
I think, and then it will all kick off September time. Nights and premieres and.
Yeah, it really gets going again, doesn't it?
The fun stuff.
The fun stuff.
I'm going to appreciate the final week of...
Yeah, I'd appreciate a quiet week if I were you. Well, yeah. thank you so much.
Thanks, Dad.
And as I say before, don't have nightmares and please do be careful out there.